You are listening to the Purely Table of People podcast. I'm your host, Nebo Mahoney, and welcome to the show where we explore what really makes a chemist. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the seventh episode of the Purely Table of People podcast. Today, I welcome Aaron Dixon to the show. He is a PhD student in Tyndall National Institute studying electrodes. He previously graduated from a master's by research and actually has an unusual undergraduate career path towards what he's studying today. I'm really excited to welcome him. He talks about the power of reflection, needing to network and know people to ensure that your career trajectory continues the way you want it to, especially if you're going to change career path in the future, whether you know it or you don't. As well as the power of failure. I really hope you enjoy today's episode as much as I did recording it with Aaron. Hello, Aaron. Welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm good. As I introduce myself, my name is Aaron Dixon. I'm a PhD student in UCC and Tyndall. I'm English. The accent hasn't pinged anyone. I'm originally from England, and I moved to Ireland when I was a teenager, and did most of my secondary school here, and then college life has been the entirety here in Cork.
Brilliant. So I suppose on that note with your college life, why don't you take us through your career journey from, I suppose, school and subject choice right through to where you are now in your PhD?
God, okay. I suppose we could start with what I was adamant I wanted to do when I was younger. Adamant. I wanted to be a vet. I was a big fan of Steve Irwin, David Attenborough. I was like, I want to become a vet. I'm going to train to become a vet. So come the Leaving Cert, I was dead set on doing veterinary. So did the interviews, did the Leaving Cert, didn't get it. And this kind of relates back to, failures and understanding that in life there's going to be failures, and whether or not you should either take it and just move on to something else or take little steps to work towards your original goal. So when I came to UCC, which was my second or third choice, I decided there was a course, biomedical science in biological and chemical science in UCC. You had the chance of doing that. And if you graduated with that, you could then go into veterinary as a graduate student. So I was adamant that that's what I was going to do. I was going to get veterinary. I was going to keep going with it. And within the year of doing... Well, within the first few months, actually, of coming into biological and chemical science, you got shown all the options you had available for you, both the biology and the chemistry. And chemistry had science education or chemistry education, where you could become a teacher. You could do a chemistry module, you could do a chemistry modules, get a chemistry degree, as well as an education degree, and go off and start teaching immediately from the gate, not needing to do a PME or anything like that. And that actually really interested me because... You know, it's one of those situations where perhaps you need to sit down and have a proper good, think to yourself, have a sit down with yourself and think, you know, why am I going towards this goal? Or do I want to be doing this? Or do I want to be doing that? And I realized that I liked teaching. I was doing grinds on the side for college and in secondary school doing Leaving Cert. And I really liked the teaching aspect. I really did. So I was like, why would I spend 4 years doing biomedical science to then possibly not get veterinary and then really being stuck and not knowing how to get in there then?
And I suppose also, you know what a teacher does day to day. You might not really know the nitty gritty of like a vet. Right?
Oh, yeah.
You see a lot of what a teacher does day to day. And maybe the teachers listening will be like, oh, there's so much more behind the scenes. But in general, as someone who has parents that are teachers, you do see the majority of what happens for a teacher's job.
Yeah. And like I had a teacher, she was teaching me chemistry and she was amazing. She was like this teacher I always wanted to be. when I started thinking about it. She really kickstarted. I had her for science and she knew certain chemistry volume certain. She really like kicked up, like got me going for science. I really like perked up and realized, this is a channel I want to go down. I want to go into STEM or some sort of STEM, you know, medicine or chemistry or something. I want to go down this route. So that was like a defining moment for me to realize, no, veterinary might not work for me, but teaching will. I like teaching. I think I'm a good teacher. I'll do that. So I did that. And for anyone who doesn't know, in UCC, you can do that course. It is a great course. It is an absolute brilliant course. And I'm saying that now because I'm about to tell you that I left it. I left it very quickly. Let's just say, first off, I enjoyed the teaching. It was really great. You start teaching in second year, and in third year and fourth year, you actually go and do teaching placement. It is brilliant. It really makes you sink or swim, but in a good way. You really start to learn things. You do all the lesson plans. You make an actual structured course throughout, you know, whoever you have, you know, first years or 6 years, you know, or in between. The first year I did it, I loved it. I loved teaching. Went into the third year, realized I was teaching the same stuff again. And then I realized, oh no, I'm going to be teaching the same stuff over and over again. And this is where I stop learning and I just teach. And that's a kind of a moment where I realized, oh, I don't want that. I want to keep learning.
You loved chemistry too much.
Yeah, I loved chemistry too much. I know that sounds kind of weird, but I had sort of like aspirations to learn something and do something and move into the unknown, like do research. Yeah. But I never actually, you know, put it to any kind of job. And it was when I was in third year, I was talking to you. I was like, I don't like this. I said, mm-hmm. I'm teaching the same course and I've got everything prepared already from last year. It's not boring, but it's becoming a bit stale.
Yeah, I suppose the joy of teaching is that you're learning about leadership and connections, and it's the people aspect that's the dynamic that changes. And what you were interested in was the subject area, and the subject area stays the same because there's a curriculum and a syllabus. And I suppose you wanted changes in the chemistry, not just changes in the social group and how that dynamic works.
Yeah, and I feel like if you want that joy of teaching, go for it. But for me, that wasn't it. That wasn't what was doing it for me. And I quickly realized that I liked the teaching, but I wanted to research. So now I'm stuck in chemistry education, which if you don't know, you substitute some of your chemistry modules for education modules. So you start losing out on chemistry modules. So I was really worried, you know, if I could get into a master's or I could get into a PhD, well, would I even be able to? Do I have enough modules? Would someone complain that I'm too inadequate in terms of modules? But I tried anyway. So I contacted...
The power of being headstrong.
Yes. I was like, nope, I'm going to go for it because I need to get out of this. I'm going into fourth year in teaching where I'm going to be doing teaching the entire year. And I said, like, I need a way out. Otherwise, I'm going to be so-so.
Yeah, I suppose you were lucky to have realized it so early. I know that's like 3 out of 4 years is quite early on to realize that that's not the career choice for you. And you had the opportunity to kind of put the next steps in place to ensure you got to the career goal you wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I did was I contacted a good friend of ours, a lecturer, and they stated that we go for the IRC. I didn't get it. I think that's a classic example of everyone who's been on this podcast. I tried for the IRC and didn't get it. I got through the first couple of stages and then failed on the last one. So that was unfortunate. But it's unusual because when you start talking to supervisors and lecturers, you start to learn context. And within academia and third level, those connections are key. Because getting to know him, I got to know a now retired professor who put me in contact with my current supervisor. Halfway through fourth year, I had an interview. My current supervisor called me in. I said, like, can you come meet me? I said, like, I know you're a teacher. It sounds really good. You sound like the proper person I kind of need. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll come in for an interview. I was teaching that day, so I had a nice suit on. I was dressed up. I walked into what I thought was just a talk. It turns out it was the interview, or a interview for the actual PhD, or master's, sorry. And there was an interview. It was just flat out an interview. Someone else came in to interview me and we started talking. He loved that I was a teacher because if you do a PhD and you do a master's, Education Public Engagement, or EPE, is key. It's something that, like, a lot of projects now in SFI funded projects or European funded projects, they want EPE. So being able to teach your subject to someone is key for PhDs. And that's exactly what he wanted from me. He said, like, I had all the knowledge. The area of chemistry was electrochemistry. He asked me a few things about electrochemistry. I knew everything about it. I was taught quite well in UCC about it. I really enjoy the subject. And there and then he said, like, you'll have to apply for the interview, but I like you. No one else has applied for it. You're the first person to ever come in to me in a while. You have it. Just apply for it. Incredible. So I was shocked. I walked out of the interview and I realized I have a way out. I'm done with teaching. I said, this is great.
Yeah, the stars kind of aligned, didn't they, in a sense?
I was so happy. I taught the rest of that fourth year and I was so happy because I knew the last day, I was like, I'm starting into the masters. So that's really my career journey. I did the masters. It was a masters originally. It was hopefully going to turn into a PhD. But unfortunately, within the year, we realized that there was just no more money left and the funding for it just didn't work out. But luckily enough, again, by knowing people and getting to know supervisors and lecturers, we got another project, which led into a PhD. So I graduated with the master's, finally moved on to the PhD, just as COVID hit. But now full swing into it, I suppose, we're full into
Brilliant.
It.
Brilliant. And yeah. I suppose just for listeners, that's quite common. Whenever someone takes on a research master's, a lot of the time, they kind of, not the promise, but definitely the hope is that it will turn into a PhD. But more often than you think, the project just doesn't align with the funding bodies and it doesn't necessarily work out. And I suppose, as you've spoken about the whole way through this so far, is the power of networking, the power of knowing people who know people and ensuring that the path is there. Because if you do have an end goal of getting to a PhD, and if you really have that end goal, you're going to do everything in your power to get there. So I think that's, like, you're the perfect example. I know that a PhD opportunity came up in your group, but you are the perfect example of someone who worked hard and made sure that your connections were out there to ensure that everything would fall into place.
Yeah, I mean, my supervisor is not here right now, but if he was here, he'd be saying Aaron was annoying me constantly for 4 months before the money even ran dry, asking me, what are we doing? Because I think at the 4 month mark before I was meant to finish, he told me there's no money left for a PhD. It's like, we're going to have to just make this a master's. And I was hounding him, going like, where can I get extra money from? What can we do? What can we do? What can we do? And I suppose I was so stressed, but he was eventually just pulled me aside and going like, why are you so stressed? And I'm like, I'm going to be finished with a master's and I wanted a PhD. And he goes like, but I have another project available for you. Did I not tell you that? I'm like, no. No, you didn't.
Communication, yes.
Yeah.
And I think that's an issue with the majority of PhD students is that, like, academics are just so used to doing this. They do it all the time and they solve the problems and they don't worry about the problems. They don't stress. And then us as students are like, oh my goodness, I don't know what's going to happen. What am I going to do next? I'm so lost. And then we just never tell our supervisors that we're feeling this way. So they never need to solve the problem until we're like a month of stress in. And they're like, you didn't tell me you were stressed. Why didn't you tell me you were stressed?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he apparently had it. He had it, the PhD set up by the month six because we joined with someone else. And it was like, oh, that would have been nice for me to have known, but he just assumed. And I was absolutely stressed out because I really liked it. I absolutely loved my master's and I wanted to keep going.
I suppose from your master's now, so you've done a research master's, which is probably not the typical master's people do. People typically do a taught master's. And now you've transitioned into the PhD. How would you compare those two experiences?
Yes. For anyone listening, the master's and the PhD are two vastly different things. With a master's, when I came in for the project, for the interview, my supervisor laid out what the actual master's was going to be about. There was a previous PhD student who had a small chunk of his research that was good, but he had to leave it alone and continue on with his PhD. But it sat there as a possibility of a branch out in research. That's what it turned into. I was given that section of research. He had a lot of stuff done with it already. And I was essentially told to, within the year, follow it and continue it on. So in the field of electrochemistry, It was a bit of electrochemistry and a bit of microfabrication. So if anyone from UCC who doesn't know what Tyndall is, we are a silicon chip micro and nanofabrication powerhouse in Ireland and in Europe. We create micro and nano devices on silicon. What we were doing in the masters was creating silicon microinductors. So here's a phone. Oh, wait, they can't see. Here's a phone. Pick up a phone. And in the phone, you have a battery. And let's say the battery is 9 volts. Your screen may require, let's say, 12 volts, and your camera may require 9. These are just arbitrary values, for example. You need to step up or step down the voltage in order for it to properly power the device. So what you have are micro inductors, which are little devices which can create a magnetic field in order to store electricity and then release it at a certain voltage. So if you don't know, electricity and magnetism are two sides of the same coin. When you form electricity, you form a magnetic field. And when you form a magnetic field, you form electricity. So by storing electricity in a magnetic field, you can change the voltage and then power things. So you have if you look at your phone, you have thousands of microinductors upping and downing the voltage or storing power in order for you to supply the various components in your phone with the right voltage. If you look at a microinductor, if you research one now quickly, you'll notice that there's a core and then around it is wire wrapped around it. The core is what my master's was about. You can change the core or the little metal material that's made out of. And by changing the core, you can improve the actual inductor on different scales or improve it in different areas. The master's was based on previous work that this PhD student had done. He had created a new method to improving the baseline metal that's regularly used in our microinductors. So he found a way to improve it. So my master's already had a foundation, researched there already, and I went ahead and did that. So I redid his work, proved that it did work, proved why it worked, did all kind of chemistry doodah to figure out why it was working, and then also created my own metal and then used his process to better it as well, or try to better it. And that's the master's there and then. Because we were in Tyndall, we were able to actually put those metals into actual devices. So I don't have any on me right now, but on my desk are actual microinductors, which I can actually turn on and generate a small magnetic field, and they can actually work and do their job. I was able to make those in Tyndall, which was fantastic. But what essentially is, the master's had a foundation, loads of research, and it was like a foundation that you knew that worked because the PhD student previously had done it and you kicked off.
It had a foundation and then a trail to follow.
Yeah. The PhD now is in electrosensing. So we're using, essentially it's the same thing, we're microfabricating electrosensors this time. So the sensors, the chemical sensors that can detect things via electrochemistry. My thesis title is literally improvements in gas sensors. In a vague sense, I'm improving gas sensors. There is no foundation. There is an idea, and you're told pretty much run whatever you can and see if something works.
It's like, we think it'll work. Now go see if it does.
Yeah. And pretty much I was literally told, right, you're to improve gas sensors.
I suppose, how have you found that process from going to from a foundation and a path to... It's like all on you to figure out from the get-go, especially in a COVID era when you were kind of stuck at home.
For the masters, I did like 4 months of reading, you know, reading up on electrochemistry, learning the physics behind it, learning about microinductors. I had to learn everything about it, right? And when I like that, a lot of that research and reading and literature reviews that I did in the masters translated over to PhD. And the masters pretty much was also a situation where I was getting proper results that were going to go into my thesis within 2 months. The PhD wasn't like that. I have yet to actually get something I have something that's decent enough, but it's going to require a lot of work before I can ever think about publishing it. And, you know, it's a case of then finally I can go into my PhD. I've had multiple ideas that have failed or fizzled out eventually, and the results can't go into my thesis. And it's like, that is exactly what the PhD is turning into.
And you're a year and a half in.
Yeah.
And I feel like, I suppose just for anyone listening out there, this is not an unusual story. This is probably the classic story of a PhD. And I'm sure that's very stressful for you and any yeah. PhD student going through that. But also, it is a common feeling of a PhD student.
Yeah. I mean, you know, typically, if you start a PhD, the first year is usually relegated to learning, researching, getting to know the topic inside and out, learning what your other colleges are doing, what your competitors are doing, seeing what kind of research they're doing, seeing gaps in research, and then aiming for those gaps. That's really what you're trying to do in the first years. Aim yourself towards a target and collect a few things you want to do and then fire at it. I had a lot of that stuff done already. So within the year, I was trying to fire stuff out, but then I also had COVID to compare with. So realistically, if I hadn't done the master's, I started just as COVID hit. And I could have spent the whole 6 months I was locked down fully in doing that research and literature, and I would have been fine. I felt like I would have been doing something. I had all that done. So my first six months of my PhD were me sitting at home, like doing diddly squat. I had nothing. I was like adamant I wanted to get into the lab. I had ideas. I had all the literature. I knew what I was talking about, and I had nothing to do. Absolutely nothing.
I was in the same boat, and it's a really weird place to be in to say, like, I've done all I can do now, and now I need to get back, but I'm not allowed back in the lab, which means I'm like stuck here, even though I'm progressing technically through the years of my PhD and burning through my money, but I'm getting nothing done.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it was. I learned some like hobbies. I gained some extra hobbies. I know how to Photoshop. And edit like videos and audio and, you know, stuff like that. I learned that stuff, which may help in the PhD. Did a bit of coding. COVID really caused a bit of a problem for the PhD. It really did. It really caused a slowdown. And even to this day.
Yeah, I suppose on that, what would be your biggest challenge? I know a lot of people I've spoken to have found COVID to be the biggest challenge they've faced, but what is the biggest challenge you've faced in your like undergraduate, postgraduate career thus far, and how have you overcome that?
I've got a few challenges. I suppose if we leave the PhD and leave the master's now. When I was a child, one of the biggest problems I had was I had a speech impediment, I suppose it was. I used to speak, and in my mind, it sounded perfect. But what actually I was doing was I was speaking so fast that the words were joined together into a cohesive blob. And I still do that to this day, especially when I get a bit too excited or I forget, or I forget to turn that part of my brain on, the part of my brain that tells my speech to slow down. So what I had to do then was I went through speech therapy. And speech and drama to get myself to slow down my speech. And now I have another problem, which is that I would start speaking way too fast. My brain tells me to slow down, and then I stutter over the words because I had to stop and then repeat it. This is a challenge that I've had since I was a kid. I didn't speak as much as a kid, and I slowly learned how to speak normally over time, and it's still a challenge that you face today. It's one of those like battles for success you always have in your life. I suppose, you know, yourself, you struggle with dyslexia. Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things, I suppose, that you have to develop coping strategies to try and make everything, I suppose, as quote unquote normal as possible.
Yeah.
To fit the kind of like structured world that we have and what's socially acceptable. And that sounds like you're doing the same thing. I suppose that must be difficult, especially when you're so into outreach and also being a teacher, like especially being a teacher and having taught classes. It was something that you're always thinking about. Do you think the transition to a research career has aided that challenge because it's only presentations you're doing? It's not every day.
Yeah. So when I was teaching, I had a scheme in front of me. I had a paper. And essentially, I had written down loads of times, slow down, slow down, slow down, slow down. I've kind of learned now to kind of press students, especially when I'm demonstrating or when I was teaching. When I asked them a question, I pressed them a little bit because some people would just nod. And I go, yep, you had no idea what I just said there, did you? So I had to like go, I said like, oh, sorry, excuse me. And then I say it slowly. And then they go, oh. And I noticed when I'm doing that, like, I've forgot myself to I forgot to slow down. With EPE now and public engagement and outreach in the area of COVID, I've had to record a lot of stuff. And what's nice about recording is that I've been able to listen back to myself and realize, oh my God, I did not slow down my speech during this period. So I have to, you know, slow it down a bit more and repeat. There have been some spectacular fails. So that's a challenge that I suppose it's never going to go away. And it's a battle I'm constantly facing. And I have lots of ways of overcoming it. But it's something that if I want to be a teacher, I'm going to have to constantly keep doing.
Yeah, fantastic that you've kind of like, I suppose, develop strategies. I think a lot of issues people encounter in like their lives, there isn't like a quick fix to. It's more like you need to develop yourself to cope with what you're going through, like whether that's like a speech impediment, whether it's dyslexia, whether that's, I don't know, like a broken toe. Do you know, you need to develop that you can still deal with life. And I suppose on that, for any students who are struggling within university, do you have any kind of tips and tricks for school students, especially as a teacher, that you have been there for kids who are in school, and also for like undergraduates, postgraduates, on how to navigate learning?
Oh yeah, I have loads. I suppose one of the biggest ones, and I've talked about it before, is the idea of self-reflection. The idea that you pull yourself aside one day and you just sit yourself down and have an honest conversation with yourself, because you can cod yourself a lot. I was codding myself for a long time, you know, thinking I want to be a vet. And then when I was doing teaching, I was codding myself saying, oh, the teaching will get better. It wouldn't. And I knew that. And I decided to go into research and I'm happy. It's the idea of sitting down and having a conversation with yourself and realizing, what are your flaws? What are you not enjoying right now? Are you happy? Are you content? And then working towards that. Like if you are in a course and you're not enjoying it, you can leave. Mm-hmm. I'm a prime example. You can leave the course. If you're not enjoying arts or, you know, medicine and whatnot, and you're really struggling, why put yourself through that? Leave and do something that you want to do. I suppose another tip and trick with, and this is something I learned through teaching, it took me a while. It's only when I went into teaching, I realized, was for me, open a book, read it. It's in there. I'm done. I never understood the idea of cue cards or.
You're one of the lucky ones.
Highlighting stuff like that. I never understood that part. When I went into teaching and I started teaching, there were so many students who had different methods. And now I realize every single one of them is valid. Mm-hmm. But if someone's pushing you on a certain thing, like, oh, use flashcards, they all work over 100% of the time. And if they're not working for you, find something else that does. There are loads of things online you can use to as alternatives, you know.
Yeah, this is a huge, I'm a massive advocate of learning your own study style and really investing time as if it's a module on how to actually study. Because it's the best thing I ever did in my undergraduate. And only because I learned how to study did I actually achieve in my undergraduate. I did half my undergraduate, maybe more than half my undergraduate, not knowing how to study. I didn't learn how to study till third year. And I wish I learned that sooner. Like previously, I was just like putting in the hours and I was just like doing the flashcards and the highlighting. But that's not my study style. My study style is like spider diagrams and color and rewriting and learning and rewriting and condensing and condensing and condensing. And I suppose giving my offset notes to random people, especially you, whenever you knew you were leaving teaching and off to chemistry.
Yeah. Thank you for your notes. Sorry. I was so, if no one knows this, but when I wanted to leave research, Niamh gave me her notes for chemistry modules because I was like, I need to know stuff in order to leave. I must know. So thank you for those notes. They were wonderful. Find your own method, find your own style, because you know, you learn throughout your entire life, and once you know your method, you will use that forever.
And I suppose we've spoken about it before as friends, that a PhD is a majorly isolating experience, and we've spoken about the stress of a PhD, and I suppose, how do you deal with that stress? What is your outlet for stress and pressure? And I know you're majorly involved in extracurricular activities within the university and have been through your undergraduate and your PhD. So if you wanted to speak about those a little bit.
For anyone who's listening, I love chemistry. So I'm a part of the Chemical Society. I've been part of the Chemical Society now for 7 years. I'm one of the probably the oldest members there. And I don't know, maybe people wonder why, but I love it. And I love doing it because I've been able to do so much outreach with it and get people to like realize their passion for a subject. I feel like you should have a passion for a subject. It's not if you love chemistry, if you love biology, if you love a certain thing, do, you know, just be happy knowing that you love it. You know, don't put it to the side. I was, you know, I loved it. So with outreach, with the Chemical Society, outreach just became a thing I was able to do and get people to enjoy chemistry, make people enjoy it, help people. Again, it came back to the teaching, you know, doing some extra grinds, helping people out. That was essentially a way it kind of, you know, if I had a bad day in the lab, I could just go and teach someone, which would, I suppose, revalidate me to go like, yeah, with the PhD, you know, I'd go ahead and teach and I feel really good about teaching. I go into a lab and I demonstrate someone, I feel really good. And you know, I feel happy that they've left with learning a new topic or a new procedure and whatnot.
Yeah, that impact.
And then you go back to the PhD and you go into a meeting with your supervisor and you're very quickly humbled by how little you know about the subject. And they're like, do you know what this is, Aaron? And I'm just like, nope.
That's all and of us, don't worry.
Yeah, and they're looking at you going like, oh, you should know this. I'm like, oh, I will. Yeah, 100%. So having this, that, you know, Chemical Society kind of helps to go like, oh, yeah, this, I am good. I am good at chemistry. You know, don't worry. I feel like I am anyway.
Yeah, I get that. That makes sense. I suppose like a PhD is so up and so down. There's no, it's not like a level thing. You're either super high or you're super low and the buck stops with you. And I think that rings so true that you need something that makes yourself validated, whether that's teaching, whether that's a society, whether that's completely an extracurricular activity that you know you're really good at running. Like you do need that balance because yeah, usually you don't feel that smart in your PhD. Which contradicts popular opinion.
Yeah, imposter syndrome is a real thing. Mm-hmm. And you may go, oh, I know it's imposter syndrome, but to actually then say to your subconscious, leave me alone, please.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do something right now. It's like, you're not worthy. And it just, you know, you know it's there. And knowing and getting to know people, the social aspect really helps. And I suppose this comes back to how I relieve stress. I suppose a lot of people do it. It's gaming. It's playing games. I have a lot of friends who are now abroad. We've all split from college. We've all gone in separate ways. We don't see each other in person anymore, but we can jump on a video game and play that and talk to one another and get to catch up with one another. And for, you know, a brief few hours, you get to forget about the PhD for just a moment. So that's having friends in any way you could possibly have is so key because it really grounds you because not everyone's doing a PhD. So to be grounded by someone else's career, you know, it's like, oh yeah, no one else is doing a PhD, but I want to know what you're doing and how's your life going. And oh, your life is stressful. Oh, well now I know that I'm not the only one.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It like validates your stress too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I suppose you're a year and a half into your PhD now. And do you have any idea of what your kind of future plans will be with regard to career? Obviously, I know you still have a while to go in your education, but I suppose, is there an end goal you're looking forward to that's making this worth it?
Yes. I mean, I suppose COVID feels like it's not a year and a half. I feel like I've done nothing. And there are people are always telling me there's going to be extensions. So, you know, it's a year and a half in, but you know, I feel confident that it will probably more than likely extend beyond 4 years, but not that much. With researching, I suppose this is very particular just for PhDs or research individuals. Future plans like making papers and whatnot is picking your what are they called? I forgot the word for them. What are they called? Publisher. Picking your publisher is a key thing you have to do. Mm-hmm. And that's something I'm looking into now is picking a publisher. But future plans in the future, like what happens after the PhD? God, I don't want to think about that. I really don't. And it's a thing that like just brings on more stress. And I think you said this to me before, and my supervisor says this to me all the time. He says, just do the PhD. Just do it. And when you're near the end, then you can think about it. You
It's
know.
funny you say that because I hated that response the whole way through my PhD. I hated it. And now I'm at the end of my PhD. Sounds pretty scary, but the final few months, let's hope. It is like, I'm like, I don't have time to think about anything else. Like, the PhD is all that matters. If that means I need to take a career break afterwards, I'm A-okay with that. Like, I'm more
Yeah.
than happy to travel and earn no money for a few months. Like, that would be the end goal. The only question I have for you, really, and the only question I could really ask myself, even, and I'm a couple of years ahead of you in regard to a PhD and graduation point, is, do you see yourself in industry? Do you see yourself in academia? Do you see yourself abroad?
I do see myself, yeah, I see myself being doing academia in terms of a postdoc. I feel like a postdoc is necessary. I like teaching. Lecturing is a hard thing to get into. Let's just point that out now. It is a hard game to get
I'm glad you
into.
brought that up.
And if you, it's a bit easier if you're willing to move abroad. And it's something that I've thought about a lot. So moving to do a postdoc in another country is a possibility. In the field of electrochemistry, we have I suppose competitors in England, New Zealand, Australia, Japan, all across Europe. There are a lot of places that are in my field that offer postdocs regularly, that if I was to take one on, it could really excel my course. But I could also easily also do a postdoc in Tyndall because they offer quite a lot of them, and that could also excel my career. The choices are limitless, yet I haven't, what not once, well, I've thought about it a little bit, but I tend not to delve too far in because then I start getting nervous and agitated.
Of
And
course.
then before even realizing, I've spent an hour thinking about the future when I really should be focusing on the now.
I suppose just whenever you spoke about, just for any listeners who are thinking about doing a PhD, who are in a PhD that don't know the stats for academia, it is 0.01% of the world's population have a PhD, and only 4% of those guys get to be academics. So just be aware of that stat. If you're doing a PhD, it's not to be an academic. That is very, very unlikely. So please, please be critically aware of those stats before you sign up to do this just to become a lecturer. And I suppose my last question for you, for all my listeners who are usually listening to the podcast, this is usually the first question, but I've decided to flip the script. So bear with me. So what is your definition of success? Just to round us up today, a mix of your career, of your personal life, what do you see as success?
I say this a lot is that with success, you have to look at failure. I've talked about a lot about failure today. And the idea of, you know, you are going to fail in some aspect in your career
I
or
think
even
it's
personal
important.
life. Yeah. And it's the idea of you get back up and you just, again, reflect and think about two options. Do you pick an entirely different success point where you decide, oh, this point is no longer obtainable, I'm going to go some other direction? Or do you do what I try to do? For veterinary, do you fight on a small hill to win the battle? Do you do biomedical, like I said, to become a vet? That's two ways that after failure you can get back on the horse and keep going. Leaving, you know, if you completely forget about obtaining something, that's not a bad thing. You know, I completely forgot, you know, failed at obtaining veterinary, and I went a completely different route, and I am 100% more happy now the way I am. Definitely, I probably would not be able to deal with the social aspect of veterinary now that I think about it. And I think with success is that when you finally succeed, you have that moment, and then it's the case of picking the next thing you got to go for because you got to have a little bit of success. And it can be like after like, oh, I finished the PhD. I have that is a huge success point in my career. What's my next success? It's getting up the next morning after drinking so much, for example. Point. So your success can be little or small, and you can have multiple. You know, right now, my success is pumping out this paper. A big success would be to finish the PhD. After that, you know, I haven't really decided. But you can make small successes about everything if that really helps you get going. I've had a lot of success and a lot of failures. And with success, you must take on the failures as well as you take the success. And it stings, it really does, but it makes you a better person.
Completely. And I think there's more to learn from failures than there are even from your successes. I heard a quote from Keith Barry, actually, he has a new book out at the moment, and he was like, you need to push to failure. And I thought that was such a good way to look at life, that like if you're not at the brink of failure, then you're not pushing yourself hard enough.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today, Erin. You've really shown the power of networking and community and failure, as I think a lot of our guests mirror that failure aspect. And I think it's so important that listeners hear that failure is okay. It's actually a good thing. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on all your favorite podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd like to thank the Royal Society of Chemistry Outreach Fund for their support and funding for this podcast, as well as the School of Chemistry in UCC for their encouragement, involvement, and support. Please reach out to us on Instagram, Twitter, or wherever you use your social media platforms and give us any feedback or comments you would like to develop the podcast with us. We're really here to serve you, so we really look forward to that feedback. Apple Podcasts seems to be the best way to help a podcast out at the moment, so any ratings and reviews on there will be hugely appreciated, guys. Until next time.